This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about when fear mixes with entertainment. Why do so many of us enjoy a good scare, even seek it out, especially around Halloween time? Are you a fan of haunted houses? Is it an experience you seek out around Halloween every year? Or would you rather do just about anything else than put yourself in a spooky situation? We want to hear from you. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana and tell us why you like to be scared in good fun or why you don't. Joining us now is Associate Director of the Clay Center for Young Healthy Minds in Massachusetts at Massachusetts General Hospital, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Med School, and horror fanatic, Dr. Steve Schlotzman. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with your titles. You're both a child psychiatrist and a horror fanatic. Do you ever find yourself having to square those interests to parents?
What would make you ask such a question? All the time. So the funny thing is that, you know, everybody Googles their doctors these days, so the kids will Google me, and they'll see me with, like, a zombie or a vampire or something, and they'll say, yeah, I can see that guy. And the parents will say, I don't know if this is for real. We really need to look into this guy a little bit more. But after some careful explanation, usually they're willing to buy into it. So it works out okay.
And while we're on the subject of childhood, you are a child psychiatrist. Do you remember when you first fell in love with horror?
Yeah. You know, actually, there's some really interesting research about that. Not about me in particular, but about when folks first realize it. So the average age that people first or see their first horror film, the first film that really scares them, it's around age 11. And given that most of these films are R-rated, and in my day, there were no PG-13s, so they were just all R-rated. It means that almost by definition, it's a transgressive act. It's like something that you're kind of getting away with, and that's kind of the fun of it. Like, you're really not supposed to be watching it, but you watch it at a buddy's house at a sleepover. So for me, it was Salem's Lot. It was a made-for-TV film. My parents were out. My sister was doing a sleepover. These vampires, when that little kid, and people have seen the film and know what I'm talking about, when that little kid floats outside the window and scratches the glass, it was to mix my metaphors, I'll quote Aliens here, it was game over. Man, I was so scared. But I remember it with this big smile on my face. And that was, I think, when I got hooked.
I feel like the same thing happened to me at that. It was that age, that sort of formative 11, 12, something like that. That was the first movie that really scared me to where I can really remember being genuinely frightened. And can you help us understand what it is about being frightened that makes us seek out that sensation? I think a lot of us go out of our way to avoid feeling jumpy or uncomfortable. But why do some of us like to be scared?
Well, we should go out of our way to avoid it if it's real. So the first important distinction is to say that there's a huge difference between the kind of fun scared.
I think we may have lost.
I'm sorry, I lost you there.
Oh, there you are. You're back.
I'm back. I'm so sorry about that. So the first thing is basically when you're really under threat, you should be appropriately scared and you should try to avoid those situations. But Halloween scare, Halloween fun, that's actually something different. And I think the reason people seek this out, and this is borne out by the literature too, is that there are folks who, just as a normal variant, are kind of thrill-seeking, the same thing that makes you ride a roller coaster or, do something that's a little bit faux risky. You're not really at risk on a roller coaster, but you like to tell yourself you are. And then there's the puzzles. Our brains love puzzles. And if you think of every good horror film, they play with pattern recognition. They show you something that's recognizable, but just a little bit off. So you got to do a double take. And that double take is actually what stirs up that fight or flight in your brain, that the region of your brain that's responsible for making you perk up and pay attention to something that you might not otherwise look at. So the example I always use is like a dog with cat eyes is creepy. Neither a dog nor a cat are creepy, but when you combine the two, you get stuck there a little bit. That puzzle, figuring out what it is that makes you scared, that's called a metacognition. And in the studies of horror fans, what they really love is thinking later about what it was that scared them in the movie or in the case of, you know, this time of year in the haunted houses, the haunted attractions that we go visit.
If our brains then are busy assembling and disassembling patterns while we engage with horror, is it fair to say that a trip to the haunted house can be quite the cognitive exercise?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, a lot of haunted houses use jump scares a lot. So after a while, a jump scare is pretty easy to figure out why you're frightened. And it is a break with pattern recognition because you're not used to things jumping up behind you, let alone if they're carrying an axe or a chainsaw or something like that, or a fake chainsaw. But it is an exercise in, like, what have they done in this room to make me uncomfortable? I went to one this weekend with my younger daughter, and the final section of it, it was just completely dark, like darker than dark, so dark that I had no idea where I was, and it was massively disorienting. Other than that, there was nothing frightening in the room, and yet I was most frightened there, and I found myself sort of puzzled. How have I been able to tolerate, you know, werewolves and vampires and zombies and all this, but just not being able to see, period, is what scared me most of all. And that told me a little something about myself, which I found really interesting and kind of enlightening.
And there are physiological responses here as well. What happens to our bodies?
So it's a neat question. If you do the studies of people who enjoy horror films, the first kind of myth out there is that, oh, well, they just don't get scared by it, and that's why they like them. And that's not true. If you take people out of a horror film and you say, did you enjoy that? And they say yes. And if you happen to have, these studies have been done, you happen to be measuring things like respiratory rate, how much they sweat, what their heart rate is doing, you find out that they're in a fight or flight state. So that primitive region of the brain that tells you, you got to get ready to either take care of business or get out of business's way, that's going on. So that's happening whether you're terrified and don't much enjoy it, or whether you're terrified and enjoying it. The people who are bored with it, they actually tend not to like horror films that much. And actually, they're a little bit more associated with psychopathy, with folks who actually are often the stars of the horror films, but aren't, you know, viewing the horror films. But then on top of that, you kick it up to your cortex, to the higher brain, and you use that fight or flight. Okay, I'm ready to run, even though I know that this is all on the screen. I know it's not real. How did this movie get to me? What did it do? And then the final piece is we love the fact that horror films are massively derivative. If you've seen one horror film, you've seen many horror films, almost by definition, and you're part of a club. And our brains enjoy belonging to other brains. We're pack animals. So you go watch Cabin in the Woods, and the horror references are flying at you a mile a minute, and it's just great fun. Everybody's recognizing what's going on.
And you say that it's exactly these sort of campy contexts of horror, the things we see all the time, that we hear the chilling music, we see the theatrics, the over-the-top gore, that allows us to actually examine fear and maybe some other questions about ourselves. What do you mean by that?
I think this stuff obviously were really happening. We say obvious, like, thank God it's not really happening. But if it were really happening, we wouldn't have the opportunity to kind of think so carefully about what it is that gets to us and that doesn't. I teach an undergraduate course in horror films, and I always tell the students that horror is like a mirror. It's like a funhouse mirror, and it gives you a view of yourself that you wouldn't otherwise be able to see. So you get to ask yourself questions in that campy displacement that you wouldn't otherwise be able to ask. Zombie films are a great example of that. Like, what's partway dead mean? That's actually a real question that comes up in hospitals all the time, and I work in hospitals. That's an incredibly difficult, existentially, you know, challenging question. But in a zombie film, you get your tongue in your cheek and have an actual real discussion about it without there being so much at stake. So it frees you up to be a little bit more creative in your thinking and to not worry about, you know, saying something that might be untoward.
Yeah, in order to think about it, you really kind of got to imagine it first. But
yes.
Now, not everyone likes to be spooked. Do we know anything about the differences between people who may or may not enjoy scary entertainment?
So we certainly know categories. They're in exactly that category that you talked about, the folks who like it and the folks who don't. And then we can look at what the folks who like scary movies or scary entertainment, scary attractions, what other things they like. And they tend to be, to more or less extent, thrill seekers. I love roller coasters. I've always loved roller coasters since I was little. My parents tell me I've loved roller coasters. I love planes. I love going up in little planes. I used to love the rides that spin around real fast and you know, stick to the side, except now they make me a little sick to my stomach because I've gotten too old for them. But it wasn't for lack of wanting the thrill. I've gone up in an open cockpit, you know, biplane. That kind of thrill seeking, where there's not like a huge risk, but there's a tiny risk. those folks often are the same people who enjoy scary movies, not exclusively, but often. Whereas people who don't really see the point to that risk. Why would I get on this roller coaster? Why would I pay good money to be turned upside down and sideways when I don't have to? I could go sit down and enjoy an ice cream cone.
It takes all kinds. How much does the social aspect of haunted attractions and horror films weigh into the enjoyment? I know when I'm walking through a haunted house, I'm certainly not walking alone.
Oh, it's everything. This is what I tell people. The worst thing you can do with a horror experience, whether it's a video game, a movie, or a haunted attraction, is to go by yourself. This is all about being with your pals and your friends, and the fact that you make friends with everybody there, almost by definition. That kind of nervous laughter that everybody shares when one door closes quickly, or in a horror film, the way you're not only expected, it's actually almost required that you yell at the screen, you know, don't do that. What are you thinking? Don't, you know, the classics, don't split up. That's the last thing you want to do. That camaraderie, that's what makes the experience.
Okay, as a child psychologist, we have about a minute left. Can you offer any advice or insight into that line that some parents grapple with this time of year around what's fun and what's truly frightening? Like my producer was telling me a story about when she was 6 years old. She was in her cute little Halloween costume, and she was knocking on doors, and Freddy Krueger answered the door, and she cried, you know? And so, like, that can seemingly scar a kid. So how do we walk that line?
Oh, so you, first of all, you let the kids know ahead of time that there's going to be people in costumes, and they are exactly that. They are people in costumes, and you make sure that you tell this to them in a calm way, and then you say to them, hey, if at any moment you want to go home, you let me know. We'll go home. I promise. I remember when I was very young going through a haunted attraction with my mom, who was kind of a thrill seeker. She quickly picked up that I wasn't quite ready for it, and she just said to the people in the haunted attraction, my son is frightened. Please leave him alone. And they did. And I think parents should be willing to step in the way and do that whenever they're worried for their kid.
All right. Just a few seconds. Top three horror films.
Oh, my goodness.
For you.
So I never get tired of Dawn of the Dead. The original, the 1978. That's number one. I am really into It Follows, which came out a few years ago. Just a wonderful take on coming of age. And then for really absolutely terrifying, the Blair Witch Project, even though I know it was the first found footage, I love camping. I cannot watch that movie within a 2 month period of me going camping. It gets to me every time.
Dr. Steve Schlotzman, Associate Director of the Clay Center for Young Healthy Minds at Massachusetts General Hospital and Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Med School. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Have a good Halloween.
Up next, we'll talk to the people in the business of scaring you. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to the topic of haunted houses, I want to tell you about yesterday's show, where we talked about the life and legacy of Ryan White. We got to talk with Ryan's mother, Jeannie White Ginder, and she shared some really incredible stories about Ryan's life, but also about the impact that his story has had on policy and the personal experiences of many people. You can find a podcast of that and all past shows wherever you get podcasts. Today, we're talking about haunted houses, and we just heard about why some of us enjoy scary things. And we're going to hear from the people that manufacture that fear. Are you someone that chases chills and thrills this time of year? Can't get enough of goosebumps and good pit in the stomach? We want to hear from you. What do you love about horror and haunted attractions? You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Joining us in the studio today are brothers and owners of Nightmare on Edgewood, Paul and Kevin Cook. Paul, Kevin, thanks for being here.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
And also with us is Brittany Pyle, the makeup and casting director of Edge of Insanity in Kokomo, and Kim Fruth, an actor and merchandising director from Edge of Insanity as well. Kim and Brittany, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Let's start with how one comes to own and operate a haunted house, or a haunt, as insiders call it. Paul, can you tell us the backstory of how you and your brother came to own Nightmare on Edgewood, which is right here in Indy, if people are looking for a good scare?
That's correct. We're on the south side of Indianapolis. Started out 41 years ago. It started out as a fundraiser for a little league on the south side of Indy. 11 years ago, we were approached about purchasing the haunted house from the little league. We decided to come together and do it, and ran for the past 11 years. just the two of us.
That's a good long time.
Yeah. So 41 years all, just 11.
So you bought it when it was 30 years old and already pretty established.
Yeah. Yes. When we got it, the name was pretty well established, came together and revamped, had some ideas and rebuilt it.
And Kevin, as you put it, you've come a long way from grabbing ankles.
Correct.
What was your role within the haunt as a kid, and what do you do now?
When I first started, I was about 7 years old. Our father was a builder and actor for Nightmare on Edgewood. He'd bring me in there. I'd lay underneath the table, grab ankles, fall asleep halfway through the night, wake up, grab more ankles, and then go home. That progressed. I did that for a while, and then I started running chainsaws. And then the last few years that the Little League owned it, I actually ran it for them as their director. And then when they decided to give it up and Paul and I took it over, now it's 24/7, 365 days a year of scary stuff.
And I hear you're the creative brain behind the haunt.
Most of it. Paul throws in when he can. Paul doesn't like to be scared, so nope. I'll bring him in and set stuff around. I'm like, okay, that room works. So we'll continue doing that.
So you just take his word on it since you're not really a horror person?
Yeah, and I believe I said he's the sick-minded one behind the entire thing, if you want to quote me correctly. But, yeah, so, yeah, he kind of we talk about layout and stuff, and we throw ideas back and forth. But for the most part, he says, hey, this is what I'm thinking. I'm like, all right, let's do it.
So then, Kevin, what are the keys to building an immersive experience for someone walking through the haunt?
You just got to think real deep and hard what scares you and then what would scare somebody else, and how to make it realistic as possible without making it dangerous, I guess. We are hands-on, so we do touch, we do pick you up, we do move you, but we have to do all that safely.
Yeah,
so not
there's
like,
a line there.
There's a very thin line.
Yeah, yeah. And so how do you instruct your actors and actresses to walk that line?
Everyone that works for us is allowed to touch, but they're given strict guidelines on mm-hmm. what they can touch and how they can touch.
Right.
And then our veteran actors, they're allowed to actually physically move people. So if you've been with us for a few years and we've gotten to know you and we've worked with you and trained you.
You know you can trust them.
We can trust them, and we know if somebody comes out and says they went too far, we know if they really did or not, because we know the guy or gal. It's a lot of just getting to know the people, the background checks, knowing that they can handle it, stuff like that.
Brittany, you know all about the creativity that goes into making these spooky spectacles come to life as the makeup and creative director at Edge of Insanity.
Mm-hmm.
How do you and your team bring these characters to life through costuming and makeup? I would imagine it's a challenge in a whole different way that a makeup artist maybe is used to.
Oh, yeah. It's challenging for a number of reasons. First of all, in our haunt, the indoor portion of the tour is themed to the early 1900s. So everything that we do, everything that we say, everything that we wear has to be appropriate for that time, for that era. So we go to Goodwill and we pick out a whole bunch of dresses and clothes, and we alter the clothes and we grunge up the clothes, and we get the closest things that we can find that are cheap and would look appropriate in the dark. And that's really where that starts. And then as far as the makeup goes, I lost my train of thought.
And so that with the makeup, you've got to redo it every night. You do it same way. Do you get creative? You have fun with it?
It depends on kind of your mood for the night and
how you're
feeling.
It's not like you're shooting a movie or a TV show where it has to be the same every time.
Right. It doesn't have to be at all. A lot of the artists, myself included, like to get very creative with it. If I'm feeling like I have a little bit of extra time, then I'll take some time on an actor and do like a more in-depth makeup or something that takes a little bit more time, or just try out a new technique that I haven't really gotten to practice with yet.
Kim, you're one of the actors at Edge of Insanity. Can you talk about what it's like to be on the other side of haunted attractions?
It's just a lot of fun. You have a lot of high energy people getting together, and we all feed off of each other.
What do you find works to really give people their money's worth, to really scare them? Is it the jump scares, or is it other things?
I am a jump scare, so that's what I do. So that's what I understand, and it's about being surprising when you're doing that. You don't want to give away where you are or what's going to happen. So in my room, we have a couple different other actors who are there to be my distraction. And that really helps set it up because they don't see me coming.
So it's like, yeah, all right. So it's like a group hunt where you've got the distractors and then you've got the person who comes and strikes.
Yes.
Brittany, are all of your actors people who enjoy going through haunts and being spooked themselves, or are most of them just people who need a job?
Well, nobody gets paid. We're a charity haunt, so all of our actors are volunteers.
So you really got to like it.
Yeah, you really got to like it. You got to have your heart in it. But no, I would say about half of our actors actually enjoy getting scared, and the other half will refuse to tour through even our own haunt, let alone somebody else's haunt, because they don't like getting scared.
Paul, I'm looking at you.
I do not like to get scared. So Kevin and himself offers our actors $100 if they can scare him throughout the season. So if you get Kevin, you get $100.
How do you know, though? You could just say that they didn't.
Oh, you can tell.
You can tell if he jumps up. Okay, so Paul, do you find the same trends with your actors? Are there people who don't like to be scared themselves who work at Nightmare on Edgewood?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. I mean, we put out we do tours every once in a while. Like just last weekend, we went and visited another haunt and opened it up to some of our actors and actresses, and they go. And, you know, when there's 50, 60 actors and 10 of them go, then you know maybe not everybody wants to go. And for me, I don't go through my own without a flashlight, to be honest with you. I just don't do it. So I don't appreciate the jump scare myself. So.
Speaking of which, do you have a rule that people can't use the cell phone flashlight?
We do, and it's hard. I mean,
people breaking them all the time, I'm
sure. Cell phones are so popular anymore, and we tell them before they go in, tuck your cell phones, tuck your keys, all the things that everyone probably says, and then we still get five or six of them a night. I lost my cell phone. I got to go find it. So.
We talk about safety for guests often. We talked about the more full contact experience that you can get at Nightmare on Edgewood, but do you also have to take the safety of your actors into consideration? Like our producer once went through a haunted house and she kicked a person.
Yeah.
And then they had to kind of talk to her and say, look, you can't do that here.
Yep.
Yeah. How often does something like that happen?
Every night.
Every single night.
We tell our actors, if you don't get slapped, kicked, punched, you're not doing your job. Most people's reaction is to rear back to swing on you. And it happens on accident a lot. Paul's one. You jump out and scare Paul, he's not going to hit you, but you're going to think you're going to get
hit. Yeah, he'll get halfway there.
Yeah.
Now, you do have people that come by and just are mean. They're in there to hit somebody. Mm. I'm sure you guys run into that too. And you just try to catch them and follow them and remove them from the scenario to protect your actors.
And Kevin, there's a word that your actors aren't allowed to use. We're talking about the proper way to scare people.
Correct.
What are your people not allowed to say? And remember that you're on the radio.
If our actors say boo, they get fired.
Oh, okay.
I hate the word boo. You hear a lot about boo haunts. Yeah. We're not a boo haunt. Paul likes to buy everything that says boo and hang it up in our office.
Just to aggravate him.
It's just not scary if you jump out and go boo. So we tell our guys don't use it.
We're talking about haunted houses here on All In. Brittany, does Edge of Insanity have a similar list of words that should be avoided? Again, you're on the radio.
Yes, we have I'm on the radio things. We have a list of things that I tell people we're not allowed to say because it's a cliche, because it's lame, because it just doesn't work, and we've heard it a million times. For example, things like boo, get out. People paid money to be here. Don't tell them get out. It's just annoying.
Okay, that makes sense.
Welcome to the Freak Show is a really big one, or anything about like squealing like a pig.
But a good scream is perfectly fine. Because that's not a word.
Yeah. Depending on your spot and if it's appropriate and if it's working or not. I mean, if it's not working, don't keep doing it.
Paul, your haunt is a family affair.
Yes.
Do they, aside from you, they all enjoy the experience?
So we have a younger sister that runs the ticket booth. Our dad assists in the parking lot and also runs our snack shack with my mom. Of course, we're the builders, designers, and then we have an older sister who won't come anywhere near it.
So she can't share in the spoils.
She won't even bring our nephew down to go through the Decon thing.
Brittany, how long does it take to plan and build what you want each season to look like between the themes and the set and the costumes?
Well, our planning for the season typically starts right after the last season just ended, the day after it just ended. We try to take a little bit of a break, but the owners tend to get a little bit ahead of themselves and are really excited for the next season and all the changes they want to bring. We start like really taking action at the beginning of the year when we start doing our admin meetings and our planning and what sort of changes we want to see for the season and what sort of events we're doing or what sort of community outreaches we're doing. And it goes from there. Then it goes into the summertime where we have all of our maintenance and all of our preseason prep and setup, along with makeup classes that I teach, auditions, cast training, all sorts of behind the scenes that leads up to the season.
And you talked about how one of the sections of the haunted house is kind of it's almost like a period piece.
Yes.
You've got old clothing and older sort of aesthetics. Do you ever base the content on, say, current things in the culture or in the news or something like that?
Not in the indoor portion because it is time specific, and we try
so
really,
the whole
really
thing
hard to keep
is
it
time specific.
Way. Not the outside portion of our tour. So the backstory of the haunt is that the inside is an asylum, an old haunted asylum from the early 1900s, where a doctor went around and kidnapped all of the most difficult, most incurable patients and brought them to his asylum because he had a massive ego and thought that he could cure everybody. So they're stuck in this sort of like haunted time loop. We come back every season. We're spirits or whatever you want to think about us. But the outside portion of the tour is modern day. It's all current, but it's set up in like a hillbilly sort of feel.
Terrifying.
Yeah, exactly.
Kevin, you call the haunt your expensive hobby, but there is sincerely a lot of craftsmanship that goes on building these sets. Can you talk about some of the features that you've worked on that really make that set special?
It's just coming up with that idea that no one else does. Trying to find something no other haunted house has.
Do you have to do research? Do you have to go and visit the other places? Because they're all open at the same time,
yeah.
And I imagine you're busy back home.
We try to go to where we can. A lot of haunts open throughout the week, and we do not do that. So we try to go see other haunted houses, make sure we're not copying and, you know, have the same ideas.
Sure.
Everyone has house scenes. Everyone has zombie scenes. Everybody has all these scenes that you – there's only so many ways you can set up a house, but you want to make sure it's not the same as some other guy.
Sure.
Like we have a big zombies that come out of a table. No one else has that around. So that was something we really wanted to do. We have elevators that move, floors that drop out, stuff like that.
We talked a little bit about the backstory of Nightmare on Edgewood earlier, but Brittany, can you tell us a little bit about the origins of Edge of Insanity? The owner, Walt, couldn't be with us today, but he told us that it almost didn't open. What happened?
Yeah. So when the haunt started out, this is our 12th season, by the way. When it first started out, it was a business venture between the owner, Walt, and his brother, Tommy. We were going to open on Saturday, Sunday, the first weekend of October. And on Friday of that weekend, Tommy passed away suddenly.
Oh.
So he had to decide from there whether or not he wanted to actually open the haunt and continue to go through with it, or if he was just going to give up on it and not continue because it was too painful for him. He decided from there that he would go ahead and open the haunt after a very brief grieving period and donate all of our profits to a scholarship memorial fund in Tommy's name that goes to entrepreneurship students. So then from that point, the haunt officially became a charity haunt where we donate all of our profits to various charities.
That was going to be my next question. What other charities other than the scholarship that you've given to in the past? How do you help the community?
Well, we give to an organization called Cops for Kids that, like, provides kids with, I think, Christmas gifts and things like that. Camp Angel, which is a bereavement camp for kids that are dealing with the death of a loved one. Positively for Paws helps us allocate some of our funds to animal rescues that are in need. The scholarship fund, like I mentioned. Those are the primary programs that we give to. But when we have the extra funds, we also give to the art program at Carver Community Center and to a mental health community program as well.
Kim, is that part of the reason you do it?
Yeah, I like knowing that all the time and energy that I'm putting in is going back out into the community in a positive way.
And we know that for most people that are involved with haunts, this is a passion project or a seasonal side hustle. Kevin, there must be something that you enjoy about being involved with the haunt. I mean, what is it that you enjoy about it? What keeps you doing it every year?
The first scream.
That's a great answer. We can just stop there.
We tell our actors, we want everybody coming out screaming, crying, or laughing. As long as we're giving some kind of entertainment, I can't afford to build a King's Island. So this is what we do.
10-4. What about you, Paul?
Yeah, same thing. I mean, all the sweat equity that goes into it, the money you spend, put back into it. You know, we go to a convention in St. Louis every year in March, and that's where we buy some new things, new masks, new props, new makeup, whatever it is, bring it all together. And I mean, we're brothers. So sometimes we butt heads, sometimes we get, you know, and it happens. But like he said, once we open the doors and we get through all the millions of steps that have to happen for us to be able to open, and you hear people scream and they're having a good time and they're giving you those positive reviews on Facebook and Google and all those things, it's just like, we made it work. You know, so.
It's the day before Halloween. Brittany, do people still have time to check out Edge of Insanity this season?
Yeah, absolutely. We are open this Friday and this Saturday night.
And same thing, Paul, are people, are you still open for another
few days? Yes, we are open Thursday, Friday, Saturday this week, and then next Saturday, November 9th.
All right. We've been talking with Paul and Kevin Cook, owners of Nightmare on Edgewood. Paul, Kevin, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
And Kim Fruth, actor at Edge of Insanity, thanks for coming out and have a great rest of the season. And Brittany Pyle, makeup and casting director at Edge of Insanity. Thanks for making the time.
Thank you very much.
Up next, we're talking with a sociologist who studies fear. We explore how fear is manufactured in haunts, if there are ethical boundaries to be considered, and what fear within a haunted house can teach us about fear in real life. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about haunted houses and not only what makes us scream, but why some of us like to scream. Joining us now is Dr. Margie Kerr, sociologist and author of Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. Dr. Kerr, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're a self-proclaimed diehard fan of haunted houses. And have been since you were a little girl. What is it about haunted houses that you're so drawn to?
I love the anticipation and the surprise, honestly. You know, the fear factor is fun and the content and actors are all really engaging. But for me, it's really about that anticipation and just kind of self-discovery, you know, seeing what's going to scare me and just experiencing new, different kinds of environments that we really couldn't find anywhere else.
What are some places that really kind of impressed you as to maybe their unique approach or maybe just how into it they were?
I think I really learned about a different style haunting in Japan. I went through a very small, just little tiny haunted attraction that was in Tokyo, and they mixed gaming and haunted attraction. And this was back in, I think, like 2014. So it was before a lot of the escape room kind of blew up in the States. But what they did is, you know, give you a storyline before you went in and a task. So, you know, you were really invested in going through and trying to do these different things and save, you know, some abused kids. And you had your own personal ghost that chased you through. And I went through by myself, and it was a really memorable experience just because of how invested I think I was in the bigger narrative. It just made all of the scares hit even harder. And I literally ran out screaming and then laughing.
And of all the things you could study as a sociologist, you chose fear. Was it a similar interest that got you into studying what makes us scared?
It was actually a result of looking at how we use fear in politics and social movements. So I definitely had kind of a new path about 11 years ago. My dissertation was on how parents organize around the idea that vaccines cause autism. And I looked at how fear was a tool, you know, to convince people and to motivate people. And so I was really looking at fear, you know, used in a more manipulative way. But at the same time, I realized that we like to do scary things. You know, we seek out fear in horror movies and attractions and amusement parks. And so I really had that question of, well, you know, fear is not all bad. So what is good about it? You know, what is it doing for us? And why would we want to seek it out when it's, you know, on the surface, a negative kind of state.
In your work, you talk about the evolution of fear. Fight or flight responses are embedded in us for survival. But how are the basic instincts being played when we walk through a haunted house?
Yeah, so our threat response, that automatic instantaneous response to startles, to threat, to the unknown, is responsible for keeping us alive. So we have it to thank for our survival. And what's fun is that we can, you know, choose to kind of activate it, choose to you know, go to environments that will leave us feeling that adrenaline and the endorphins and all of that intensity in the body. And when it's actually paradoxically safe and in a context of fun and entertainment, it feels really good. The natural high is definitely a real thing. And for some people, you know, it's more intense and they get a little bit more of a kick out of it. For others, it's not a physical reaction that they like, that they, you know, can even really experience as positive. But it's really a haunted houses and horror movies are a way to kind of manipulate our emotions to get the feelings that we want to feel in a context that is safe and fun.
And you've actually taken your experience in studying the science of fear, and you've used it to help design some haunted attractions. What are some of the first things that you think about when you sort of begin to create a spooky experience?
Yeah, I start with the senses. I start with, you know, what can we manipulate to kind of throw people off balance and disrupt predictions? Because a lot of what is scary is what is unknown and what is unanticipated, or what we, you know, we expect that we'll be walking one way and then all of a sudden, you know, our balance is disrupted. We're, you know, can't really figure out which way is up or down. And so I really start with trying to figure out how to manipulate the senses independently. And then also, you know, how can I create an environment that is so overwhelming that it's kind of a sensory overload kind of experience. So I start there and then think about designing in a way that is really taking people on more of an emotional roller coaster. So it's not all just about the startle or, you know, blood and guts or monsters and mayhem. It's really about balancing that with then some absurdity and laughter and some comedy and, you know, balancing lighter places with darker places. So really playing with the range of going from, you know, one extreme to the other and just keeping that going all the way through.
Do you have kind of a fun example of one that you've built that you're really proud of?
I help with one scene where we put people in a coffin and had them listen to an audio recording that I had taken from a bunch of different really old speeches that I just found on YouTube of very charismatic authorities talking about just random stuff. And I slowed it all the way down. And it was a kind of a sensory deprivation in the sense that they were in a coffin, so they couldn't get out and it was totally dark. And then they had this distorted audio you know, that they were listening to. And it created a very intense feeling of anxiety and, you know, and fear. And then when the actor would open it, they opened it with a big startle. And it was, you know, people just experienced that kind of like relief and then also, you know, laughter. So I think that was a fun one.
and there's a line that we need to draw, right? When we're talking about manufacturing fear, for, like some haunted houses you've worked with have pledged to never depict scenes of sexual violence or domestic violence. Can you talk about how you make decisions around those kinds of ethical boundaries?
Yeah. So for me, I actually borrowed from the comedy world and the practice of never punching down. You know, you want to think about who's the victim here, and are people going to leave with reinforced negative stereotypes? Are they going to leave with a feeling of a furthering of yeah, negative stereotypes? And if how can we create it to kind of flip that narrative, to flip the power dynamic? I think that a lot of content can be used in haunted houses. It's a matter of really thinking about who's going to leave feeling empowered and who's going to leave feeling like they just were kind of put in a bad position or forced to engage with things that are sometimes a little too real, like sexual violence. You know, a lot of people are not going to find much fun, scary in that content. Some people might, but I think that for me, the goal is always entertainment and more of adventurous kind of hero's journey.
And we kind of talked about fight or flight earlier, and those basic survival instincts being kind of put to the test in these environments. But in the real world today, we're not necessarily scared of a saber-toothed tiger chasing us down. But fear is still a very real thing in many people's lives. How have the roots of our fears changed?
Yeah, and this is something I think about a lot, because it's, you know, there's still very real things to be scared of in our environment, especially, you know, in different cities, in different socioeconomic statuses. There's more violence in some places. There's more threat of, say, natural disasters in some places. So, you know, the U.S., each kind of geographic location still is going to face different environmental or, you know, in the moment threats. But our opportunity to avoid threats is greater. So, you know, we can kind of shutter ourselves away from the world more easily and have everything delivered and never really have to leave our house. And I think that that's not really the best thing, because the more we avoid engaging with stressful things, the lower our tolerance goes, you know, the more scary fear becomes. And so I think that it's a matter now of really being thoughtful about what is actually a harm to us in our environment, and choosing how to navigate that in a way that is not totally avoiding the world, but is still safe. So, and of course, a lot of our fears are more related to the future. So, you know, what is the environment going to be like in the next 50 years? And financial concerns, a lot of safety issues are based on long-term planning rather than just that in the moment, you know, charging bear.
I mean, I think we can learn from haunted houses. What can we learn about fear from haunted houses that we can apply to our everyday fears?
So my colleague and I and our Greg Siegel, he's a cognitive neuroscientist at University of Pittsburgh. And we found that, you know, when people choose to do scary things, they do feel better. And they also do feel like they've learned about themselves and they've challenged themselves. And that's related to improved mood. So we're thinking that, you know, these types of scary experiences can be a way to practice fear, basically. So to practice being afraid and to build that sense of resilience and confidence, you know, it can be just a moment that you can have in your memory to think, you know, oh, I did this thing that was really scary and really stressful, so, you know, I can do this other thing. Or just to learn about how your body responds to stress, just to have that embodied awareness of, oh, okay, my heart is beating really fast right now, but I know that this won't last forever. I know that this is something that I can endure. So, you know, it's a lot like rock climbing or even choosing to do something physically stressful, like running a 5K. It's about knowing your body under stress and having that history of getting through it, of getting through the stress to the, you know, to the success.
Dr. Margie Kerr, she's a sociologist and author of Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. Dr. Kerr, thanks so much for your time, and have a happy Halloween.
Thank you so much. You too.
I will. And now we're going to check out an interview that I did earlier this week about another Halloween-related event happening on Halloween night. Take a listen.
Composer Bernard Herrmann enjoyed a storied career, scoring films from Citizen Kane to Taxi Driver. But his score for Psycho is probably his most timeless. And tomorrow night, the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra will be performing the score live during a Halloween night screening of Alfred Hitchcock's 1960 classic, not the 1998 remake.
Correct.
Here to talk with us about it is ISO Director of Communications, Kristen Cutler. Hi, Kristen.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
So this is going to be a pretty scary night.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's one of the perfect ways to celebrate Halloween. You never know what the weather's going to be like, so it's always nice to just stay inside.
As of right now, the weather's not looking great.
Right, I know.
This might be the thing to do.
Exactly.
Have they done this before?
So we did Psycho a few years back. I think it was about 5 years ago we did Psycho. So it's been a little while. You know, a lot of folks maybe weren't able to make it the last time we did it, or you just love the movie and want to catch it again. There is nothing like seeing a film with the ISO performing the score live. It's amazing.
And it's got such, this particular score has got such an interesting story, because they only, when the studio did it, they had a very limited budget,
And so Bernard Herrmann could only work with the string players.
Yeah.
And so the same is happening with the ISO, I'm assuming?
Right. So we are performing the score just as originally written, note for note. And so you have the film is being projected on. We've got a huge film screen. So it actually kind of gets back to the original purpose of the building, of the Hilbert Circle Theater. It was originally a movie house. So it's pretty cool to have these concerts where we go back to the original purpose of the building and also looping in what we do as an orchestra in a really magical way. So.
But everyone who doesn't play a string instrument essentially has the night off.
Yeah, I mean, if you're not written in the score, you're not showing up that night.
Well, it's going to be a great time. I don't know, how long does it take to prepare for an event like this? This is a one-off event. This is the only time you're doing this.
Right. It's a one-off event. So really, the bulk of the prep work, obviously, our musicians are prepping their scores early. But our principal pops conductor, Jack Everly, he is amazing at this type of work. I mean, he's amazing at a lot of things. But the films require this interesting level of preparation where he's prepping his scores. He's watching the film ahead of time. And then he has a screen that'll be at the podium with him. And it gives him cues to make sure that everything is lining up exactly in time, because it's not, you know, we're not doing musical theater or something where we have, you know, that human back and forth interaction. That movie is going as it was originally created, and we have to play the score exactly to the movie as it exists. So it's a very technically challenging piece of work.
Timing has to be perfect.
Exactly.
And these are professionals, so we're going to get it.
You are. And it's this iconic score that everybody knows. So it's not one of these things where it's like, oh, you know, they won't notice if it's off. No, everybody knows exactly what it sounds like. So so that expectation is there, and we're going to bring it. So.
It'd be a good way to spend Halloween. But let's look at the rest of the schedule for the rest of 2019 and maybe even into 2020. What else is coming up that's
interesting?
Yeah,
we have a lot of awesome stuff coming up. So just taking a look at the film series as it goes, as the Bank of America film series goes throughout the year, we started off with a little Star Wars action. We had some Return of the Jedi.
Gotta
so
do that.
Always great. And then we go ahead and Valentine's weekend, we have Casablanca. So hitting another classic, right? You can't go wrong there. And then later on in the spring, we have Mary Poppins, the original. So we're hitting a little bit of something for everyone this year with the film series. We're really excited about that.
Oh, great.
Yeah. On the classical side of things, we have coming up starting in January, we have a really awesome celebration of Beethoven. Now, of course, as a classical entity, we're playing Beethoven just about every year regardless. But next year is special. It's the 250th anniversary of his birth. So this is part of a worldwide celebration of Beethoven. So 3 weeks in January, we're having concerts on our classical series where we're performing the first five symphonies that Beethoven wrote. And we have paired each one with an original commission. So we have current, young, active composers who are writing new works inspired by Beethoven's symphonies. So we'll pair each symphony with this new piece written specifically for us. So it's going to be a really exciting time.
And good work closing out on the fifth, of course.
Right.
The most famous symphony.
Exactly. Exactly. And then, of course, the month of December, we have Yuletide.
Oh, Yuletide. Yeah.
Right, right.
So, always a pleasure.
Exactly. Always an exciting time. So really a little bit of everything going on this season. And you don't have to be an expert in classical music to enjoy the ISO.
And especially not to enjoy tomorrow night as well. Get that slasher shower scene and you'll just be shaking in your boots the rest
exactly,
of the week.
Exactly. Exactly. Can't go wrong there.
Well, again, the ISO performing the score to Psycho live tomorrow night as part of the Bank of America film series, 7:30 at Hilbert Circle Theater. Kristen Cutler, thanks for your time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. Of course, get the podcast wherever you find podcasts. Next time, we'll be talking about the various education referendums. Referenda? Referendums? That you might see on the ballot next Tuesday. Join us tomorrow at this time for that conversation. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.